Hello and welcome to Biz News Radio. I'm Felicity Duncan. As many of us hunker down in our homes for the coronavirus lockdown, some people are looking to the future and asking, what does the world look like once the virus is defeated? That's coming up. Don't go anywhere. Well, the coronavirus has been with us for several months now, and many of us are currently locked down in our homes, avoiding going out, avoiding going to crowded public places, probably even avoiding going to work, as we try collectively to flatten the curve, to slow the infection rate, and help defeat the virus. But many people, as they sit at home dealing with kids and their partners and the boredom and frustration that comes along with lockdown, many people are looking ahead to the future and asking, what is the world going to look like when we finally defeat this virus? Whether that's through the development of a vaccine, through the development of more effective treatments, or through a general reduction in the spread, in the infection rate. Now, it's not easy, of course, at this point to say how the world will be once we get out of this, but there are a few important indications and a few suggestions of the ways that some things are going to change in the future. First, on the business front, one of the things that's going to be very obvious when the dust settles is that we have lost many small businesses. There are a lot of small service businesses, whether they're restaurants, hairstylists, massage places, beauty parlors, all kinds of personal service businesses that are going to struggle to survive the lockdown. They're going to struggle to get by without any cash flow for a period of several weeks. And we are likely to see the death of a lot of small businesses as this lockdown continues. Another area that is probably going to undergo some changes is the workplace. As many, many people switch to working from home, a lot of companies are going to realize that working from home is possible and that there may be cost savings for businesses that encourage employees to work at home rather than maintaining expensive office space. This is not to say, of course, that all jobs will become remote. It's not possible for many lines of work, of course, but it is to say that we are likely to see growth and expansion in remote working now that this grand experiment with remote working has shown just how much of what we do on the daily in an office environment can be performed at home just as effectively. We're also likely to see changes to healthcare systems around the world. This virus has really highlighted how underprepared many of our healthcare systems are for something of this magnitude. They've really illustrated the weaknesses of our healthcare systems, especially in places where there is a kind of bifurcated healthcare system with one system for the rich and one system for the poor. We are starting to see those health inequalities become a major political issue. And looking ahead, we are likely to see at least some pressure for change in the way that we manage our healthcare systems, and certainly for more investment in health capacity. One of the things that the virus has highlighted is just how poorly stocked many of our hospitals are. They're really lacking in life-saving equipment and in personal protective equipment for medical professionals. So we're likely to see a lot more investment, I would say, in healthcare in the immediate future. Whether that is sustained or not going forward is uncertain. On the financial and economic front, another thing that we're going to likely see is higher taxes around the world. Right now, governments everywhere, including in South Africa, are rolling out some extraordinary stimulus measures to try and see the economy through this difficult period. And in fact, you know, it's not right to say stimulus measures. We're not trying to stimulate the economy so much as we are trying to keep it alive while we're in lockdown. In a traditional financial crisis, governments will try to get people to go out and start spending and try to get companies to start investing. But that's not what we're doing now. In fact, we don't want people to go out and start spending. We want people to stay home and stop spreading the virus. So most of the measures that we're we're seeing now are not actually aimed at stimulating the economy. They are aimed at sustaining the economy during the period of lockdown. Thus, it's a very different approach to what we've traditionally experienced in times of crisis and recession. And of course, it is something that's going to have to be paid for later. And I think that in most places around the world, we are going to see some increase in taxes to try and defray the costs of smoothing the economic hit that the virus has given us. There's also, of course, the danger that we're going to see long-term economic damage from the coronavirus, that the stimulus measures that government is rolling out is not going to be enough to help us avert an economic crisis. We've already seen massive job losses in economy after economy as the virus has swept around the world. And there's a real danger that the economic damage is going to be long-lasting, that we're going to be looking at an extended period of economic dislocation, recession, downturns, however you want to put it. We are potentially in for some very rough economic times. Now we are going to take a listen to some audio from the Bloomberg PNL podcast, in which the team discusses with various experts what the future is likely to look like, what the post-coronavirus landscape is going to be like in the United States, looking at how the virus is going to change the economy, how it's going to change the world of work, how it's going to change healthcare in America. And as you listen to this, I'd like you to think about some of the implications of all of this for South Africa and what some of the changes in the US economy may mean for us in SA, whether it's how we're going to do something similar or whether it's how that change is going to impact our economy. Take a listen.
Welcome to the Bloomberg PNL podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most noteworthy and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg PNL podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as at Bloomberg.com.
$2 trillion U.S. stimulus package coming out. That's equal to about 10% of the nation's total output. The question is it enough? Francis Donald, Managing Director, Chief Economist, and Head of Macro Strategy at Manulife Investment Management, joins us to lend her thoughts. So, Francis, thanks so much for joining us. We're starting to get some initial details about this stimulus plan. What is your early read as to kind of the scope and scale of this plan?
Well, like almost every data point and policy move we get, unprecedented, huge, massive. But just like every other policy we've seen from other governments, it's not going to be enough to prevent a massive dislocation in this economy. We are still going to experience a recession, what I call a compressed recession, in a very short period of time. This package is about mitigating just how bad that might be and preventing it from creating other spillovers that last an extended period of time. So for me, this doesn't really change how I think the next 3 months go. It does give me more hope that by the year end, we have seen a little bit more of that recovery. I'm not in V-shaped recovery. I'm in U-shaped recovery. Not sure how much the distinction matters. It's good news. It's not a savior.
So a lot of people are looking ahead to initial jobless claims tomorrow. A lot of economists are just throwing up their hands and saying, we don't know. I mean, this seems unprecedented. The range of outcomes is so wide that it's very hard to make a forecast. What are you looking at to give you some sort of compass through this period?
We have to look at a lot of different alternative data sets, things I've never looked at before, like subway ridership. How many people are there? Looking at open table reservations, looking at surveys that we maybe haven't seen before. This is really difficult to forecast. And there's a reason why the Fed threw up its hands and said, we're not giving you the summary of economic projections. Basically, the only way to do forecasting here is to take an economic model and break it, push through a bunch of assumptions that are based on just various scenarios and hope it gives you some point forecast. But that is false precision. What we need to be doing now is thinking about the progression, the quarter by quarter progression, and how does anything that happened in the next 3 months create longer term damage? I do think we need to realize that we can't and we probably will not unwind all of the damage that we see in the next 3 to 6 months, that there are structural changes that are coming from this. And most importantly, a lot of the policies that were put in place, monetary and fiscal, are not going to be unwound in 3 months. So we kind of have to distinguish here between what's going to rebound and what isn't. That conversation is so much more important than what is the GDP hit, what is initial jobless claims going to be.
So what do you think some of the structural changes might result out of this, Frances?
The biggest one is, if I'm opening a company right now, I'm thinking twice, three times about, do I want a global supply chain? We haven't just had one hit to global supply chains, the tariffs. We've now had a second, entirely different one. So if I'm opening a company, I'm thinking, yeah, maybe I'm going to have to pay for domestic labor, which is more expensive, but that's a form of insurance. I also think that we're going to get a sense that people can work remotely and do not need to travel into downtown cores. That could change housing markets. It can change the way companies operate. It can change the push towards new and better technologies for remote working. These are the types of conversations that we need to have. Of course, the biggest one is we have now, you know, expanded the Fed's balance sheet to something unprecedented. We now have deficits that will blow out across the entire world. And I don't think you're going to have anyone who says we shouldn't have spent that amount of money. So even our notions of what's the appropriate role of a central bank and how much money should government spend is going to change as well.
Frances, that's exactly where I wanted to go, this idea that the deficit is now going to double to where it was. You've got helicopters dropping money. You've got the Fed basically saying, we'll buy whatever you want, with expectations that the Fed's balance sheet, which already is at a record high now, is going to at least double in the next 12 months, if not far sooner than that, to more than $9 trillion. At what point is this inflationary versus deflationary?
So eventually that will create some inflation. And this is why I think we're seeing a steeper curve. It's why you're going to hear people say, I'm a seller of the 30-year, that inflation is coming. This is why you're going to see people who like gold in this type of environment. But for the meantime, particularly in the next 6 months, we are going to have to deal with demand destruction. And in my view, that demand destruction is going to be so much more powerful than any sort of inflationary dynamics that come from these policies. We also have a very strong U.S. dollar, and that is a deflationary force. I don't think that strong U.S. dollar is going to unwind significantly this year. So yes, do we need to think about inflation? Absolutely. Do we need to think about it in the next 12 months or even 24 months? I don't think so.
So, Frances, you're talking about, you know, more of a U-shaped recovery. Do you, in fact, think that we will see a recovery in the third quarter? Is that going to be pushed out maybe more to the fourth quarter? This could be a lower for longer type of hit to the second quarter.
I suspect you're going to see some seeds of the recovery by the third quarter. And by that, I mean you will see shops open back up and some rehiring activity. Are we truly back online? Do we start to see an economy that even resembles where we were in January? Probably not till the fourth quarter. You know, we have a supply shock, and then we have two types of demand shocks here. We have forced closures, which mean even if you want to buy a latte at the coffee shop, you can't. And then you have this other type of demand shock, which is just confidence-based, which is saying, you know, even if the store is open, I'm too afraid for my personal safety to go outside the house right now. A lot of these can be cleared up. Supply chains are already coming back online out of China. That's good news. You can press a button and or sign a paper and open up a segment of the economy. But it's probably going to take a little bit of time before we have people who are generally happy to go to concerts or movies again. That's a more of a confidence shock. Those are really difficult to forecast. But, you know, just thinking it through, I don't think we're all going to be going around shaking hands by June.
Frances, just real quick here, I'm wondering how much of the economy is still online that's getting discounted, basically that the American business community hasn't gone to zero as people shop online and order stuff online.
Yeah, right. And we see a variety of different types of companies that are hiring because there's a segment of this economy that isn't just holding place, but is going to reaccelerate. And what they're seeing is just like, you know, the full weakness of the economy isn't going to rebound. I suspect the strength in those particular industries, everything from telecom to online shopping, they're not going to lose all of this bump either as we continue to have this structural shift. So certainly we're going to see some front-loading activity in March. Watch grocery store sales for March. They're going to be through the roof, but it's going to be substantially offset by the significant amount of downward pressure we have from small businesses, restaurants, job losses. Those are going to significantly outweigh.
Frances Donnell, thank you so much for being with us. Frances Donnell, Chief Economist and Head of Macroeconomic Strategy for Manulife Asset Management, joining us on the phone from Toronto. Really interesting to try to forecast what the society might look like on the other side of this. We don't know how long it's going to be, Paul, but there does seem to be a feeling things are going to be very different in certain ways, at least.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, her economic outlook, more of a U-shaped recovery than some of the V-shaped recoveries that we've seen come out of Wall Street over the last 3 or 4 days. Our next guest, Hans Olsen. He's the chief investment officer at Fiduciary Trust Company in Boston with about $14 billion under management. Hans, thanks so much for joining us. What do you make of the market performance over the last couple of days? Are we kind of forming maybe a little bit of a bottom here, or is this just a dead cat bounce?
No, I think we're in the very early stages of a bottom formation here. With the Federal Reserve's action being joined by the Congress's actions, I think we have the conditions now to start to put a double line underneath this episode. So I think we're in the early stages. There's definitely some probably shockingly difficult headlines we'll have to deal with in the week ahead. But most importantly, I think we've got the beginnings of a base being formed.
You know, there's a question here, how you get some conviction at a time of such lack of conviction when it comes to economic forecasts. I'd love to get your sense. How do you gain a sense of assurance behind your call that we're getting stability and it's time to perhaps buy?
Well, I think you have to look at the credit market, because in our commercial lives, the sort of the wellspring of all the activity starts with credit, right? With money changing hands and the ability to get credit to transact. And, you know, what we've seen over the last week or so is severe dislocation right across the credit landscape. And what we're starting to see now is some normalization beginning to happen in that space, whether it be yield spreads on investment grade bonds or high yield starting to come down. Once that we start to get a return to normalization there, that will flow through to the equity markets. And I think they're both happening at the same time at the moment.
So, Hans, one of the areas that's been a little bit troubled, obviously, in the credit side of the business is the mortgage markets. What's your take on what's going on there and kind of what the response has been from the Fed?
I think the Fed's efforts have been really good in addressing the primary markets. And then we get into the secondary markets, especially in commercial-backed mortgage paper and the like. I think there needs to be some help there on the part of the Federal Reserve. They need to basically supply capital to that part of the market so that some liquidity is there and we get a sort of the beginning of a return to normal trading. It's not there yet. There's still some distressed sellers, some liquidations occurring. But if the Fed turns its considerable resources there, that will start to tamp down as well.
Hans, we're speaking with Hans Olsen, Chief Investment Officer of Fiduciary Trust Company in Boston. Hans, I'd love to get your sense of how you go about buying in this situation, given the fact that it's very hard to depend on any actual data that we've previously relied on, like earnings or estimates, to get a sense of what the financial picture is.
Yeah, I think that's a two-part process. One, you have to sort of look through to the other side of this. So if we fixate on the data that we see in front of us right now, we're always 2 to 3 weeks behind the curve. You know, whether it's the PMIs and the like, with the PMIs, some of them are just beginning to reflect the sort of the severity of the drawdown. But I think if you focus through and to a recovery when we get return to a bit of normalcy, then I think it's just a matter of having exposure. It's really more of a beta play than it is trying to pick an individual stock here or there. Things have sold off so systemically and in some cases in such a disorderly way, just exposure to markets now in the base formation is, I think, the first step into a successful reemergence of this from this period.
So, Hans, for the brave of heart that are willing and able to look to the other side of this, where should they be looking?
Well, I think the U.S. Is the first place. I mean, we have liked international names for some time, but it's hard to imagine the global economy emerging from this global slowdown or this global crisis without the U.S. leading the way. We tend to be the most vibrant and most creative economy, and you know, it would be a break with history for us to come out of a global slowdown without the U.S. Leading the way. So I think the U.S. is the first place to be. I think credit is beginning to look pretty interesting. I would go credit first and then equities second, just because credit has to recover before equities can recover. So if you have incremental money, splitting it between those two sectors of the capital markets would seem to me to be a good idea.
All right, so where in credit? Because we've seen an outperformance in the past couple of days in investment grade as the Federal Reserve backstops that asset class, but high yield has continued to underperform as people expect the default rate to spike in the wake of the shutdowns.
Now, places that we're looking at right now haven't pulled the trigger, but we're sort of doing the work on would be leveraged loans. Those are down trading in the 70s now, and those are implying default rates and recovery rates that probably won't come to pass given all the extraordinary efforts on the part of the central bank and now Congress. And then once that starts to catch a bid, I think we'll see a bit of a recovery in high yield. Already, though, high yield OAS is down from the peak that it achieved just a couple of days ago.
So, Hans, it's interesting, looking out to the other side, are there sectors in the economy that you would look at? Would you look at the ones that got really crushed, whether it be leisure or the airlines, the transports, that type of thing?
I think that for us, where we would look first would be areas like industrials. Actually, there's pretty good picking in technology, although that hasn't sold off as much. Energy, some of the top names in energy might make a lot of sense here. They have the wherewithal, the balance sheet, the depth of business, and the access to resources in order to lead our way out when we start to get a bid for energy prices. So it would be energy, it would be healthcare, it would be financials at some point here in the States are going to look pretty interesting. So some of the areas that have gotten hit harder, but focusing really on the larger companies in those sectors, because those are the ones that will lead out. It, in an environment like this, it's hard to see how the smaller companies lead us out of this.
Hans Olsen, thank you so much for being with us, and take care of yourself. Hans Olsen is Chief Investment Officer, a fiduciary trust company in Boston.
Volatility in the markets, a little bit of weakness here today after that a tremendous and historic rally yesterday. Was that the start of something new or just a bear market bounce? We have Aaron Dunn, co-director of Value Equity Investing and Portfolio Manager at Eaton Vance with us. Aaron, thanks so much for joining us. Give us your thoughts of kind of what we're seeing in the market over the last several days. Obviously, tremendous volatility, but what are some of the themes you're looking at?
Well, I think you've gone through a couple of weeks here where you've had a lot of technical issues in the market, whether it be sort of leverage calls, et cetera, that are exacerbating massive moves in the market here. I think more technical factors have been driving the market. What I think we're starting to see, though, is a little bit more of an attention to fundamentals, and it's really what we're trying to sift through for ourselves in terms of how we come out on the other side of this. And you know, this is an unprecedented time. It's a downturn that many struggled to foresee, and so I think it's sifting through the winners and losers on the other side of this. I don't think it's going to be back to business as usual in a month or two. I think there's going to be some lasting impacts. I mean, I think the American public is probably at some point here going to get very anxious to get out and get back to life as normal. So sort of looking at that and saying, who are the big winners here and maybe a little bit of a new world? Who are some, that I think are going to struggle once we get on the other side of this?
Aaron, that's exactly where I wanted to go. I was looking at some of your research ahead of this, and you were saying, don't look at the next round of earnings. It's no longer a leading indicator. Look beyond that. But it enters the realm of theory, of sort of philosophy, of what will sort of be the most missed aspects of people's lives. So how do you go about kind of handicapping the big winners on the other side when you really cannot look at the numbers to determine that now?
Yeah, I think the numbers are so in flux that, you know, the next quarter's earnings, I mean, you had basically half a quarter in the books if it's a calendar quarter earnings. And we had Nike come out today that had some excellent results driven by the rebound in China and some of the online sales they were able to book. And I think that's one differentiator for retail companies. For us, we want to really look at, because the current environment is in such flux and earnings numbers are in such flux, and a company with a calendar quarter that has a call in late April, I don't know that there's a ton of informational value in what they're going to report, right? They're going to say it's really challenging. We want to make sure we have liquidity to make it through. Don't know when people are, you know, really going to go back to life as usual. So there is some fundamental look here on what liquidity looks like. And that's one thing we've also been very focused on. We like to own quality companies with low leverage at Eaton Vance. And so we're looking at make sure our companies have plenty of liquidity to get to the other side of this. And so some things we're looking at are, you know, very liquid, well-capitalized retailers. Looking at derivative plays on the other side of this. So, you know, maybe not owning capital-intensive airlines or cruise ships. We're not really interested in going there. We're not interested in something that's going to get a bailout. But there's some derivative plays on the other side of this that are interesting. You know, I think one example we look at is plain vanilla as this may be, we look at corrugated box manufacturers, right? I mean, Amazon is still delivering. They've announced a big increase in employee base. So plays like that where you can see some fundamentals that come back much quicker, they actually go through this with smooth sailing. Stuff like that I think is extremely interesting here. And looking at kind of 2021, 2022, what later this year when the market looks forward, what's normalized earnings number look like? That's how I think you sift through today's environment to the other side of this, is looking at what the impacts are today, but looking what the impacts are for 2021, 2022 is going to really embed a lot of upside in portfolios today.
Paul, I love Aaron, that. Go long boxes, yeah, and go exactly. long pajamas, because that's what people are doing right now.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So Aaron, as co-director of value equity investing, how's value done in this market route?
It's been very tough. And I'll tell you why. I think we were looking at coming into this, you had really a couple of years where growth outperformed value massively. And that's because you had these big growth tech companies that had excellent balance sheets. And so in our view, as we went through last year and into early this year, the market got very narrow in a lot of these big tech companies. I mean, look how big Apple was in the index. Look how big some of these other companies were in the index. They drove so much of the upside relative to the rest of the market. The value benches tend to be have much more of a cyclical grouping, and that's happened over the last couple of years as energy's fallen more into value, you know, materials have fallen more, industrials. So the value bench tends to be a little more cyclical. Now, it does have more exposure to defensive groups like utilities, REITs, et cetera. So if you look at performance of value, say, versus growth, if that's your comparison, value's underperformed growth quite a bit. But I also think that's the opportunity here is a lot of these spaces that have really been decimated have the opportunity to sort of to rebound the most on the other side of this as we get a little more visibility in the cyclical recovery here.
Aaron Dunn, thank you so much for being with us. Take care of yourself and your family. Aaron Dunn, co-director of Value Equity Investing and Portfolio Manager at Eaton Vance, talking about the road forward, how you even start to sort of game out what might be the other side, Paul. I mean, honestly, the concept of even collective working and
yes,
the concept of exercise, I mean, you just have to wonder how much will go back to the same versus be fundamentally changed.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how we all come out on the other side of this.
Well, a lot of food for thought there from the P&L team. And I think I want to emphasize one thing that I think is particularly important, and that's the discussion of how the virus may change global supply chains. Now, if it is true that countries like the United States and countries in Europe are going to start to bring production back home to try and avoid the kind of vulnerabilities that the coronavirus has exposed in these long global supply chains, that is going to have major implications for South Africa. Now, of course, South Africa is not a manufacturing giant. We don't have a lot of export-oriented manufacturing. Mostly what we export is raw materials and minerals rather than finished manufactured goods. But one of the strategies that the Ramaphosa government has for a long time been saying that they would like to pursue is to pursue export oriented manufacturing to try and get involved in global supply chains to try and take advantage of the opportunities available there. Now, if global supply chains are going to shrink and shorten, that is going to really change South Africa's strategic options for the economy and for boosting growth. We will no longer be able to do what those Asian countries did 20 or 30 years ago, which is, you know, start to create export processing zones, start to get involved in manufacturing and shipping finished goods into the West, into developed countries in Europe and into North America. If the supply chains change so that we are no longer able to do that, that's going to need to, South Africa is going to really need to rethink its strategies for boosting growth going forward, because the path that was followed by countries from Taiwan to China to Malaysia, that path is no longer going to be available to us in the post-coronavirus world. So plenty of food for thought there as we hunker down in our homes, protect our families, protect our communities, and try to flatten the curve. That's all we have time for. Thanks for joining me. If you'd like to read a summary of this podcast, there is one up on biznews.com in the premium section. Don't forget, you can sign up for premium. Just going to cost you £5 a month, and that £5 will get you access to all of our great original premium content, as well as full digital access to the Wall Street Journal.